right? Give it up, ladies and gentlemen. The incredible Miss Alex Dupree. She going to make me run on up out of here. 9 o'clock. She going to make me run and go get in the car. That's what I'm going to do, but that's all right. All right, so we've come to yet the end of another amazing show. We're back to school, and we're going to do it each and every night on the show. Thank you to Mr. Jared Matthews, our DJ and technical engineer, better known as DJ Flo. Thank you to our news anchor and the love of my life, the incredible Miss Robin Lewis, everybody's favorite uncle, Uncle Mal, Mr. Mallory Saunier. And don't forget to go to therealchatdaddy.com for more information on how you can be a part of my world each and every day. Coming up next is Carl West with his wonderful Tuesday Night Business Show. I love you guys so very much. I'll see you tomorrow night at 6:35 p.m. with my good friend, Miss Heidi Barker. We're going to tear it up tomorrow night. Single mamas and dating issues. I love it. I love you guys and one.
Number now being spotted with waters becoming increasingly rough in the ocean. The river has enough salt water for the dolphins, and even a manatee was seen swimming the river today. Signs of a storm certainly being felt. Heavy rain on and off with conditions expected to deteriorate late tonight. Clayton Neville, Jacksonville.
Hurricane Dorian has sustained winds of 110 miles an hour and is 110 miles from Cape Canaveral, Florida. 14 people are still missing and 20 bodies have been recovered after a deadly boat fire off the Southern California coast. Coast Guard Captain Monica Rochester says it's never an easy decision to stop the search for survivors.
We know that this is a very difficult time for families and friends of the victims. We have suspended these search efforts due to no additional individuals having been witnessed entering the water. Our last aircraft overflight this morning has revealed that no additional signs of distress or debris has been witnessed.
Walmart has changed its policies in the wake of three recent mass shootings.
The company announced that their stores will stop selling short barrel and handgun ammunition. That includes .223 and 5.56 caliber ammo, commonly used in what people refer to as assault rifles. Walmart will continue selling what they still have in stock, and when it runs out, that'll be the end of it. The company is also asking people to refrain from open carrying in Walmart stores.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 285 points, the NASDAQ off 89. I'm Ann Cates.
Did you know a fire department responds to a fire every 24 seconds? This Fire Prevention Month, First Alert is reminding you to install smoke and CO alarms on every level and in every bedroom of your home. And always remember to test your alarms regularly and replace the batteries every 6 months. To eliminate the need for battery replacements, install 10-year sealed battery alarms. Learn more about reliable protection you can trust at firstalert.com/fireprevention month and visit Lowe's stores today.
Summer's ending, and savings are back in business with Dell's Labor Day Sale. Small businesses can save up to 40% on select business computers with Intel Core processors, plus free shipping on everything, including a wide selection of thousands of top-brand electronics. Give our specially trained small business technology advisors a call. They can help you find just the right tech to fit your business with Labor Day Savings. Visit Dell.com/businessdeals or call 877-BUY-DELL. That's 877-BUY-DELL.
An Aussie vegan has sued her neighbors over their lifestyle.
An Australian vegan named Scylla Carden has taken her case against two of her neighbors all the way to that country's Supreme Court. Her issue? That one of her neighbors grills meat in their backyards, a smell that she finds offensive.
You smell fish. All I smell is fish. I can't enjoy my backyard. I can't go out there.
Carden's suit also alleges her neighbor's cigarette smoke was bothersome and that their children play basketball too loudly.
It's been a turmoil. It's been unrest. I haven't been able to sleep.
Her case was already thrown out by the Supreme Court, but she's filed 600 pages of documents to appeal that decision. Carden claims her neighbors are antagonizing her intentionally. I'm John Stolness.
Margaret Atwood's The Testaments, her sequel to The Handmaid's Tale, is among six works up for the Booker Prize for Fiction. Other finalists include Salman Rushdie's modern take on Don Quixote. I'm Ann Cates.
Message and data rates may apply.
If you're considering going back to school, ask yourself the following questions. Do you need the flexibility to take classes on your schedule? Do you have college credits you need transferred? Do you want to earn a quality degree from a world-renowned university? If you answered yes to any of these questions, Arizona State University is the perfect school for you. Arizona State University offers over 200 highly ranked degree programs 100% online. you'll earn the same degree as you would on campus from wherever you are on your schedule. Plus, ASU Online accepts most transfer credits. For information, text ACE to 35517. Learn for yourself why the Wall Street Journal ranks ASU fifth in the nation for producing the best qualified graduates and why 88% of ASU grads are recruited within 90 days of graduation. Learn to grow, learn to succeed, and learn to thrive at Arizona State University. To learn more about ASU Online degrees, text ACE to 35517. That's ACE to 35517.
I'm Kimberly Agoin. Join me, along with Salim Wakil and a distinguished panel of scholars, as we look at the past 400 years of our life in North America. We'll explore the impact of slavery from our arrival in 1619 to present day. Listen for this thought-provoking program Wednesday, September 4th at 5:30 p.m. and Thursday, September 5th at 8:30 a.m. Be sure to visit WVON.com or our Facebook page for a podcast preview. It's a conversation that must be heard. And the only station that is bringing it to you is WVON.
With news and information coming to you from every direction, here's a team you can trust. It's The Commentators, WVON's exclusive group of thought leaders sharing their perspectives on everything from politics to business to community, from every angle and every side. It's Kimberly Agoin, Carl West, Abdul Hakim Shabazz, and Yolanda Joe. The Commentators, the most exclusive club in Chicago. Join them weekdays, 9:20, 5:20, and 11:55 p.m. Are why we're the talk of Chicago. The Morning Show, weekday mornings at 6 a.m.
Tommy on the talk of Chicago.
I can tell you that as I stand here on the pulpit on today, I have to ask the masses of people, how damn dumb can you be? Goodbye.
It's Maze and Todd, weekday mornings at 6 a.m. on the talk of Chicago, 1690 WVON. On the next Midday Show with Perry Small.
Trump enforces Title X gag rule, which is a direct threat to black women's health, and customer service with Dorothy Tucker.
Perry Small, weekdays at 9 a.m. on the Talk of Chicago, 1690 WVON.
The views expressed on our programs are not necessarily those of WVON, Midway Broadcasting Corporation, or our participating sponsors.
From 1619 to 2019, 400 years later, we remain descendants of slaves. Reparations now.
You're listening to Far West, The Art of Business on WVON.
Theme song, man, just gets me moving all the time. It's my theme song, man. That's the Jigga Man. It's indeed. Woo! It hypes me up every trip. It's especially cruising down Lakeshore Drive at about 1 in the morning. You drop that on? Of course, there's lyrics to this, but we can't play it on the radio because Jay puts in work on this song. Man, he tells it like it is. So y'all go pull this song up and listen to it one day. All the lyrics, man, it is just, it's just a cold-blooded song for all the hustlers in the world trying to make something themselves, like me. Yes, indeed. Hey, what's up? This is Carl Webb back at you on The Art of Business on Tuesday night, every Tuesday night from 9 to 12 midnight on WVON. Last week, I had a guest host, Mr. Bruce Montgomery. I want to thank him for filling in and his guests that participated in the show with him. It's always nice to just take a break once a month on a Tuesday night, and Bruce has been kind enough to fill in on that particular, I think it's the third, is it the last set, last Thursday, last Tuesday of the month he fills in, right? So here I am, back at you, Carl West. I love this show. It is just an amazing opportunity for me to interview some of the best and the brightest people, business people in this country who are doing incredible things. And it's just been a labor of love to bring this to the WVON audience every Tuesday night. As I stated before, this is like week 19, if I'm not mistaken. And we've have interviewed some, man, some heavy hitters. We've interviewed some startups. We've interviewed people who just trying to figure it out, because this is all about building wealth. And that's why I call it the art of business. How do you do business with the scope of building wealth, creating capacity, which allows you to employ your community, which allows you to build progressive neighborhoods. And so that's how this thing is all laid out. So look, I'm glad y'all tuning in tonight. Check this out. This is the first time, because of a request to one of my good buddies, Mr. Larry Ivory from the Illinois Black Chamber of Commerce, that we are allowing calls to come in on this hour. I typically do not take calls until my last hour on the 11 o'clock hour, because I like to have my guests kind of just have no interruptions as they lay out the game plan for building wealth, as they talk about their business growth. But tonight, Larry was like, man, let's take calls, man, and get people engaged, involved in this show tonight, because we got a great guest that was recommended by him. But, of course, he's a guy who would have probably made the list at some point. He's on the list, but he moved up because Larry said, you got to have him on, Carl. And when Larry talks to me, I make it happen. So, anyway, call in 312-374-8130 to voice your opinions, ask questions of our guests. And here he is right now, Dr. Jeffrey Sterling. What's up?
Hey.
Doctor, you there? Dr. Jeffrey Sterling, what's up?
Hey, I'm great. How are you doing?
Hey, man, it's Tuesday night, man. This is my night to shine, brother. I'm always doing well
there you
on,
go.
On a Tuesday night. And I'm always feeling good when I can have credible guests in the studio, either calling in to talk about what they do and how what they do benefits the community, as well as help them grow a business and build wealth. Because when you build wealth, you're able to take care of your family, again, hire, take care of communities, man. It's the most important thing we can do out here. So glad to have you in. What's up? Tell me about yourself.
Hey. Well, thanks for having me. Basically, what you've been talking about is more or less my life's work as applied to healthcare. I was born in Cook County. As luck would have it, I actually came full circle and trained in Cook County. I'm an emergency physician by training. So after about 20 or 25 years of practice, I came to the realization that what I was trying to do was to save the world, and doing it one patient at a time actually proved not to be the most efficient way to do it. So I took advantage of some additional training that I received as a public health professional, and it really turned my focus more toward taking care of communities. And that's particularly important given the existence of healthcare disparities in the African American and other diversity communities. But as these things go, I've spent quite a bit of time with my healthcare consulting and implementation firm addressing communities all over the world. We've dealt with dozens of countries and states across the United States in doing that. But as these things go, there's another level. As I like to say, there's always another level. And even as I got into the business of taking care of communities, I realized that if you really want to have the most profound impact on healthcare, there are actually individuals that do that simply by writing a check. Think about the effect that Bill Gates had on the continent of Africa just by being able to write a check to address some of the considerations surrounding HIV. And as luck wouldn't have it, in the African-American community, there really are not enough individuals that take that mindset and deal with what really are the social determinants of health. It's real easy for us to look at this consideration and to say that, you know, you have bad habits and you do bad things and you get ill as a result of it. But really, it goes back to what you were saying. There are conditions and circumstances that if we control them, we're able to lay the groundwork for good lives. And there are things that are social determinants of health. Simply put, health, education, employment, these things are intertwined. So what I've done professionally is really try to create coalitions and to engage in a public health series of initiatives that really empower communities to have those social determinants of health in place, to live better lives, and to also become more empowered and independent and living their best lives across the spectrum.
Sure. Look, I want to do some community health cleaning, house cleaning, some community house cleaning. You actually made me think of this when you said a few things. One is, why do you think, and this is just, again, some community house cleaning stuff, right, that we're going to deal with. Why do you think more blacks, prominent blacks, do not pay attention to the continent of Africa in terms of supporting it and investing into a place that's considered, that's their motherland? I mean, and you, of course, you can't speak for them, but you can make a doctor's honest assessment of why you think blacks just don't make that kind of commitment. As you mentioned, Bill Gates has spent billions of dollars trying to eradicate malaria and HIV in the African continents, and we have not seen black people really move up. I mean, you would think that they would see him and say, wow, right? What can we do to not, even if we joined his effort, what do we do to make sure that we are protecting the birthplace of black civilization? I mean, just give me your thoughts, and you can be as brief as you want or take as long as you want.
Well, we actually could have an entire show on that topic, but I will. we won't do that, but I will actually address your issue by saying that I actually just got back from a two-week trade mission over in Johannesburg, and I'm actually going to be going back in December over to Ghana. So I personally have come to that revelation of which you speak, and really feel that to answer your question. And by the way, it's not just a benevolent endeavor. There are tremendous economic opportunities over there. So I would actually suggest one of the things that I discovered pretty startlingly in my career was that I never became more American than when I left the United States.
Really?
The rest of the world actually craves American productivity and ingenuity in ways that you may not appreciate when you're trying to conduct a business stateside. So, you know, when I've done business over in Indonesia or Tokyo or in pretty much anywhere else in the world, it's amazing how the look in the eyes of the individuals across the table from you make you realize that they actually are looking at you as an American much more so than the stigma with which we may be addressed here in the United States. It's a fascinating proposition, and that really makes the climate of considering doing business elsewhere in the world very intriguing, because the soil is moist and ripe for planting, so to speak. But back to your question. I think that, you know, that is such a complicated set of concerns. I think that before anyone or any business can be mature enough to do business elsewhere, you really have to address what's happening in your own hierarchy of needs.
Sure.
Before you actually have a group of individuals that are prepared to save the motherland, so to speak, you have to realize that there's a lot of saving that needs to go on here in the United States. The battles with healthcare disparities and the reduced life expectancy and the economic disparities that exist here in the United States really render our existence such that too often the conversation is about how do we survive, particularly black men. So you have to flourish before, I mean, you can only flourish after you've survived. And much of what we're dealing with here in the United States, you know, if you think back to that old Maslow's hierarchy of needs, you know, you have to address the things that are basic to the human condition, providing your family with food and shelter and protection and those types of things. And too many of us are simply stuck in that part of the equation, and you really have to mature beyond that before you can even think about conducting business. And you have to have mature, sophisticated businesses able to compete with vendors around the world before you can take your wares around the world and do what needs to be done. So we're not talking philanthropy here. We're talking about actually conducting business. So there are individuals, as I mentioned, I do it, and I know of many other individuals who do business, conduct business elsewhere around the world. But as an organized effort to suggest that as a business community, we're in a position to pick up and to solve the problems of another continent, even it being the motherland, really looks past the challenges that we have right here. And I would suggest that many individuals make the what they deem to be the correct decision, determination in their own minds that their best efforts are to address the challenges that we have right here.
Dr. Sterling, that is an answer that I can completely agree with, but it was definitely a wonderful politically correct answer as well. And I respect that completely. Now, the second community house cleaning, before we get into the depth of your company and how black businesses need to be more involved and how we need to be considered for economic growth from government and also local government as well. Why do you think, and I ask this really every time I meet a doctor, and one of your statue, I'm sure, can help with this. How in the heck do black folks lead in every health disparity in this country? Why are we at the top of the list of everything that's wrong? That, to me, is just absolutely amazing. I can't even understand how everything, every disease known to man, created by man as well, black folks are at the top of when it comes to the suffering part of health. Why is that?
Well, I mean, that's the wrong question to ask a physician, so let me put on my public health hat, and that's the correct answer.
Okay.
The correct question to ask a public health professional.
Okay.
Look, as I mentioned, there are things called social determinants of health. Health isn't just something that you pop out of a box and have. I mean, the infant mortality rate in this country, once again, you have to ask the questions about who has access to care, who has access to prenatal care. And you start there. Black women have a dramatically lower access to prenatal care than their counterparts. That translates to a dramatically higher rate of low birth weight infants. And all of those types of, all of the disadvantages that come with that are already baked into the cake at that point in time. So we're actually getting off to a slower start than our counterparts in that regard. Now, when I talk about social determinants of health, there are other things that simply continue to run a slower race relative than the competition. If your household is the highest receiving food stamps and your food choices are going to be less nutritious and less able to develop a strong body, which is exactly the case in black households across the country and in Illinois, than our counterparts, then we're going to fall behind. if the unemployment rate in the black population is double that over other ethnicity rates and three times that of whites, which it is in the state of Illinois, then health is going to fall behind. Because if you're being asked to make a choice between putting food on your family's table and paying for an expensive prescription medication, you're probably going to feed your family. And that allows health disparities to proliferate, diseases to become more advanced, et cetera, et cetera. When you have blacks at the highest percentage of all ethnicities and demographics that have a higher percentage of kids living below the poverty level, et cetera, et cetera. Blacks also have a higher proportion of those living with a disability than whites in Illinois and across the country. So these are the things that you have to address before you even get involved in the conversation about health proper.
Okay.
So social determinants of health are a thing, and you have to realize that there are things like health, education, employment, healthy environments. Think about what happened in Flint, Michigan. How are you going to have a healthy community when that community is drinking water filled with lead?
Yes.
There are social determinants of health, and as long as our community is economically disadvantaged, then we're going to end up with health disparities. That's hand in glove consideration. So you can start there. And then when you want to move into the conversation about health, there are really three legs to the stool. There's access to care. And this is true regardless of your socioeconomic status. If you're African American, you're poor, middle class, or even if you're rich, you actually statistically have lower levels of access to care than your white counterparts. So if you don't have access to care, you're not getting health care preventative consideration, which means that you're only entering the health care system probably at the time in which an emergency has occurred and you're showing up in an emergency department. And that's not the place where you're going to have the best possible outcome. You also see people like me in the emergency department because black folks tend to have a lower rate of, don't tend to have, we actually have a much lower rate of having insurance. So, these are things that before you get into the prevalence of disease, access is so important, and the cost of care is a different consideration. When you do go to an emergency department, the emergency department is the most expensive portal of entry into the healthcare system. And that means that, well, the number one cause of personal bankruptcies in this country have long been hospital bills. So an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. If you're gainfully employed, which I said, relatively speaking, we're not, you're able to have employer-paid health insurance, which means you're going to be able to get some preventive stuff, which means you're going to do better. When the employment rate is so much higher, unemployment rate is so much higher in the black community than it is in the white community, it stands to reason why the health numbers tend to fail. When the education numbers are so much worse in the black community than they are in the white community, you can see why the health numbers necessarily follow to be also poor. So all of that feeds into this whole consideration. And we haven't even talked about speaking of hyperbole, when you talked about damn near every disease known to man, actually there's a specific list, and this list tends to correlate with the most common causes of death in the United States. But those things do tend to disproportionately affect African Americans, and that whole concept is called healthcare disparities. So there's just a whole tsunami of considerations that affect African Americans and produce the health challenges with which we're faced. And once again, maybe one of the next questions you'll ask me will relate to the things that we do to ourselves to produce bad health on top of all of these other things that I've mentioned. But it's important to point out at the beginning of the conversation, the social determinants of health and the disadvantages that we have that are based on economics really are as important as anything else when it comes to determining how good a community's health is going to be.
Dr. Sterling, I want to thank you for putting on your other hat. Your other hat to answer that question. And we're going to leave that right there for now. Like you say, this is a subject that we can probably talk about during a whole show. But I will say this, everything that you mentioned about why the disparities show up, run rampant in our community. One thing that we can do, which is what this show is about, is the art of business, and that is building wealth. And by building wealth, we're able to hopefully give ourselves, give our communities better services to better have more improved outcomes in terms of our health. I would assume that's correct.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, then that's why we're going to talk about building wealth. And you are a man who's out here building wealth. And I really appreciate, you know, the role that you play in this because, again, as being the proprietor of a company, several companies for that matter, that is attempting to or has generated wealth for himself, for yourself and your employees and your family, as well as someone who is serving the community on the other side, wearing a hat, trying to solve some of the ills of our community through being a physician. So I appreciate the dual role in which you play in this space. And so with that being said, now, you own three companies, correct?
That's correct.
Sterling Initiatives, you're the president and CEO of that. You're the president and CEO of SI Medical Supplies, LLC. And then what was the third company here? You also own, what's the third company? I'm missing one. I said three. Sterling Initiatives, SI Medical Supply Company, and what else?
It's called Systems.
Systems.
Mm-hmm.
And what is Systems? I don't think that was listed here in my notes I took. What is actual Systems?
Well, Systems, it's actually spelled S-I-S-T-E-M-S. It stands for Sterling Initiatives, Sterling Emergency Medical Solutions. So that gets back to my medical practice. I actually work with hospitals to provide emergency physicians who staff emergency departments. Unlike your family doctor, when you go to an emergency department, those emergency physicians are part of a group. And one of my business units actually is a company that provides physicians to hospitals to staff emergency rooms. And the reason why that occurs is because having a company allows me to create a certain level of quality control. When was the last time you heard of a physician having a supervisor, for example? Well, that actually is the case in my company where we actually provide counsel and oversight and corrective action and education for our doctors who take care of patients. So it's not just that you come into an emergency department and you have a doctor that's taking care of you willy-nilly. We actually make sure that when patients are seen at one of our facilities, they're actually getting a level of care that's consistent. All of my businesses are based on best practice implementation. So in this example, we just want to make sure that physicians actually are practicing to the standard of care in emergency medicine.
Okay. And you were the past president or media president of Northwestern University Black Alumni Association. Are you past or current president?
Oh, no, that's very much past. I did that for 4 years, and it was a hoot. Well, we could have another show about how much
you
fun said, that was.
You
it was
said
a great
hoot.
Time to.
I ain't heard the word hoot, but, man, since I was
yeah,
left
well,
Mississippi.
Yeah, well, I've been spending. You know what? And believe me when I tell you, that actually is the appropriate word. That's not a word we use a lot in Chicago, but that's exactly what it was.
Okay. Okay. Well, great. So you co-founded that organization, actually, huh? Yeah.
Oh, no. I've co-founded a lot of organizations. The Northwestern University Black Alumni Association has been around for just about 50 years. What I did inside of the organization is that I wrote a book that I created along with a wonderful partner, the first archive of the Black experience that our history had never been documented. And in creating that archive, we did several things, including collecting artifacts, documents, and other considerations from alumni dating back as far as we could go. I was also the author with, again, the same co-author, Lauren Lowry, who documented for the first time the history, the 140-year history of Blacks at Northwestern. That book was called Voices and Visions, The Evolution of the Black Experience at Northwestern University. And I also was executive producer, conceived and constructed a film called The Takeover, The Revolution of the Black Experience at Northwestern, which talked about the 1968 takeover of the financial building, the bursar's office at the university, that led to tons of changes at Northwestern that made.
What year was that? What year was that?
Life. Oh, that happened in 1968.
Oh, really?
But all of these things that I'm talking about happened in the last couple of years. So,
wow.
Yeah, that was the experience at Northwestern.
So the very first Black person to attend Northwestern, happened 140 years ago?
That's right.
Wow. So does Northwestern have a long history of admitting black people, or is that as of recent?
Well, again, you know, you can draw a line in the sand. There's pre-1968,
okay.
Or basically about pre-1967 or so, because once they started to let people in 1967 or so, the year immediately plus or minus that, the folks that they let in really were the group that, as I mentioned, took over the university and made it so that the growth became exponential. And from that point forth, the university has evolved to a point to where the enrollment rate of African Americans is roughly about 10%.
Do you know Dr. Khalil Muhammad?
Yes.
Oh, wow. He's a good friend of mine. I know he told me that him and his group was one of the first ones, and correct me if maybe I don't want to be incorrect on this, one of the first ones to force Northwestern to do a PhD in African-American studies.
Yeah, actually, again, one of the specific demands that came out of the Bursar's office takeover of 1968 was the development of an African-American studies program. And that, you know, that's a long story, and that took a couple of years after the demand was agreed to actually have that unfold and to take its place into what is now a robust department at the university.
Wow. Wow. Do you still participate in, I'm sure you do, but do you still participate a lot in Northwestern activities?
Oh, very much so. My whole reason for spending 4 years doing it is that the activities in which our team was engaged really surrounded the 50th anniversary of the Bursar's office takeover.
Oh, wow.
So that was just a wonderful opportunity to bring back generations of African Americans that had been disgruntled and left, and those that stayed and loved it. But it really was a grand development of community at a higher level than had ever existed before, perhaps with the exception of that 68 group, of course. But it made being black at Northwestern a very powerful and enjoyable thing for the alumni.
Man, when I said the best and the brightest, man, I didn't know you was going to be that good and that bright. Oh, my God.
I'm just doing the best I can.
Oh, my. Well, you're doing a great job, man, and I'm excited to be talking to you. So let's go into the business side and the fight that you're on. Tell me, how did you get involved with the Illinois Black Chamber of Commerce, first of all?
Well, one of the interesting way in which this came together, when I was president of Northwestern's Black Alumni Association, one of the initiatives that in which we were engaged was economic empowerment.
Okay.
And we were looking to have the university, which is a $2 billion a year entity, provide opportunities for its alumni. There's a lot of business that's being conducted at the university, and we felt that some of that business should be given to African-Americans in general and African-American alumni in particular. And in looking for ways in which best practices could be implemented to that end, I happened to gain the acquaintance of what's now a very good friend, Larry Avery, who's the founder and president of the Illinois Black Chamber of Commerce. And after many conversations and ways in which he assisted what we were trying to do in creating some economic empowerment and portals of entry into doing business with the university, you know, we just continued to talk. As luck would have it, I simultaneously founded the Dallas-Fort Worth Minority Business Council's Health Industry Group. And through those activities in the Dallas area, I actually was able to bring together 100 black businesses to, you know, it's this thing that, you know, these businesses always are looking for binders of black folks, you know, to put a spin on the old Mitch Romney line.
Sure.
You know, and creating capacity is a thing. And most people, when they think of healthcare, they don't think of the fact that healthcare is a almost $3 trillion a year industry. They think that it's just something that physicians and nurses and a few other professions do. But people don't tend to understand that healthcare actually represents 17% of the gross domestic product. And what that means is one out of every $6 that's being spent in this country is being spent on healthcare. And that's business.
That's big business.
And we tend not to think about that. That's huge. There's nothing bigger unless you're talking military. So I had already developed a footprint for economic empowerment in the healthcare industry, and I tell you, I don't think I'd been done with Northwestern for about 5 seconds before Larry came calling. Larry Ivory came calling and asked me to serve as the chair of the Illinois Black Chamber of Commerce's health industry group, which has been a pleasure to do because, you know, Chicago's home. It's always going to be home, and as luck would have it, the challenges in Illinois are just absolutely amazing. And again, we really do need to spend some time climbing into the weeds on the situation that exists in Illinois. But in short, you will recall that back in when state Medicaid expansion occurred as part or the partner to Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act being put in place, the state of Illinois decided to try to fix its cost by doling out about $10 billion a year to insurance companies called managed care organizations. And that created a win-win by which the state wasn't going to see eternally escalating cost, and the insurance companies were going to get a huge pot of money and would be able to manage those funds to its own profitable interest. One of the considerations in that paradigm was that there was a diversity spend target of about 20%. Now, when we say diversity spend target, we're talking about considerations such as blacks, Hispanics, women, disadvantaged businesses, service disabled veterans, et cetera. So the idea was that 20% of the money that was being spent by the insurance companies, the managed care organizations, was supposed to have been spent in these diversity communities. Well, long story short, these entities successfully argued that they should be allowed to siphon off about 85 to 90% of that money at the beginning of the conversation, because those were dollars that were directed to direct patient care, as if somehow diversity firms couldn't be involved in that part of the equation. But they were successful in getting that done. So what then was left to be accomplished was, check this out, an approximate spend on an annual basis that was eligible somewhere in the $10 billion range, okay? So as these things go, that proportionately meant that in the African-American community, there was an expectation that about $850 million was going to be siphoned into the black business community.
Wow.
It's a lot of money. However, if you think about that $10 billion that's over there, maybe it's not that much money. But as these things go, the deal that was negotiated was that about $850 million was supposed to have been siphoned into the community. And for one reason or another, the amount that actually has been spent in this community has decreased over the last 6 years. And again, this is data that I've been able to access from the Department of Health and Family Services. And the amount of spend that's actually occurring, $850 million is the target,
right,
has been about $5 million.
Hold on.
I'm going to pause for effect there.
Hold on. From $850 million committed to spend, so far only $5 million has been dispersed out.
No. This is what's happening on an annual basis. So this has been going on now since about 2012.
So it should have been $850 million annually, but thus far it's only been about $5 million annually.
And the number, unfortunately, has been dropping. Now we have to pivot and really get into the whys of that conversation.
I was going to say, what you contribute that to?
There's a lot to that. So at the beginning of the conversation, I do want to throw a disclaimer out, because I know a lot of the individuals that are working to try to accomplish this goal.
Sure.
And you really do have a lot of good people out there that are really working hard to try to accomplish this goal. Hard stop. Okay. One of the things that I always say in my business is activity is not accomplishment. And as these things go, the labor of some truly fantastic professionals who do this as their life's work all day, every day, just hasn't been successful in getting the job done, dramatically so. However, you know, the first thing that people will want to throw back at us when we ask them why this is the case is that, you know, people will always say there's not capacity. We have a hard time finding those binders of black folks, to paraphrase the old Mitt Romney line. So the question is that a legitimate argument? Are there indeed a paucity of black businesses in the state of Illinois that are available and qualified to conduct business with these insurance companies?
Insurance companies are either healthcare providers. I mean, it's both, right?
No, that's a different conversation. Healthcare providers are physicians and nurses.
What I meant was these health conglomerates: Northwestern, Rush, University of Chicago, University of Illinois. That's what I meant. This is a part of this is part of their commitment.
Right, but the specific entity that we're talking about that's receiving money from the state
is insurance.
Are called managed care organizations. Okay. You're talking about entities like Aetna and Illini Care, Blue Cross Blue Shield, those types of entities that you would get your insurance from, for example. Now, the big hospitals like the Rushes and the Northwestern and the University of Chicago, they also have diversity spend targets themselves.
Right.
And the numbers are just as bad there. So, you know, really it's six on the one hand and half a dozen on the other. But what I want to really focus on is the proposition, the presumption that there are no black businesses in the state of Illinois. Okay. And I just want to say as emphatically as I possibly can, that is absolutely not the case. The work of the Illinois Black Chamber of Commerce, particularly the work that I've been involved in over the last couple of years, we've actually been able to demonstrate pretty emphatically that there are hundreds of businesses out there. They're members of the chamber who have capacity and who are ready, willing, and able to do the work. It really is a function of whether or not the opportunities are being presented. So, you know, I don't want to do a hard stop here because I know you're still in shock over the comment that I made. But what I want to do here is I want to make a very important point that really sums all of this up, because we were talking about the social determinants of health at the beginning of the conversation. And we're talking about the economic disparities that exist in the black community across the state of Illinois. Whether or not there are qualified black businesses, and I'm saying they are, a few others might say that they're not to the level to where you can spend $850 million. The point that I am making is that you cannot accept as an answer there are no black businesses. At some point in time, somebody in government has to say, how do we build the bridge so that there are sufficient numbers of businesses to create the wealth in this community that will eradicate the social determinants of the health? If you don't have a situation where whites are earning twice as much as blacks all across the state, and by the way, that is a true statistic. If you don't have that situation, then you're not going to see the healthcare disparities that exist to the same level. So part of this as a survival mechanism is that you have to create wealth in the black community. You have to create black businesses as a means of eradicating these healthcare disparities. Now, as a public health consideration, it is also true, it has been shown for years and years, this isn't even new research, it has been shown that culturally sensitive and culturally specific practitioners do a better job in our communities. So you need more black physicians, you need more black nurses, you need more black businesses that own these things, because remember I talked about access?
Yes.
Well, people who choose to work in our communities tend to be us. So unless you are giving us the money to put up health-related businesses in our community, and if you're creating enough physicians to go work in those communities, then it's not going to happen. And that's a big part of the reason why access to care is so poor in African-American communities. It keeps coming back to economics. As I mentioned before, and this has been my journey, the hierarchy and the journey from simply being a practitioner, taking care of one patient at a time, to being a public health professional, taking care of communities, to controlling the economic purse strings. Those economic purse strings ultimately are the determinant of health. And until a bridge is built that allows African Americans to gain a certain amount of self-determination and economic empowerment, you're going to continue to see the same things that you've seen. So those professionals, both in government and in control of the spend dollars, have to come to the realization that it's not enough to say there aren't Black businesses, even if there are. I'm saying they're not. But what you have to do is you have to make a commitment to get all of these businesses that you may say today are not qualified. You have to coach them up. You have to give them opportunities such that eventually, even a generation from now, you do have an army of qualified Black businesses in the state, because this cycle cannot perpetuate itself. And now the only things that people are being offered are subcontracting opportunities that perpetuate second-class status among Black businesses. You have to create wealth, and that is what we're advocating for in the chamber. As a matter of fact, I'll blow your socks off with this one. You know, we actually have put together, I have put together a specific proposal that asks for $350 million a year for the next 5 years. And that proposal is going to do a couple of different things. First of all, that proposal is going to be, as is suggested, would run through my company, but we would bring in over 100 Black businesses and generate wealth. So you'd have an army of businesses all aligned toward the same goal. That project would then create wealth up and down the state with all of the Black businesses that we know exist that affiliate with the chamber, for example, and other entities across the state, but no one else can seem to find them.
So does this proposal goes to where? Who will get this proposal? The state agency?
That's right. That's where we start. I want to stay focused and have you see where I'm going with this.
Okay.
The purpose of this proposal is really to create a level of empowerment in the African-American community. But that's a 1A consideration. The primary purpose of this proposal really is to generate a specific set of healthcare outcomes. Because as I mentioned, we didn't talk about it in great detail, but there are dramatic healthcare disparities that exist in the state of Illinois. So because these disparities are a result of limited access to care and increased costs in our communities, the way to address those considerations are through our businesses. So we are going to take a self-determined stance and do what it is that needs to be done to take care of our communities with the money that was supposed to have been proportioned to us, but these other entities haven't found a way to enlist us and engage us to that end. So we want to clean up and improve the healthcare disparities that exist across the state. And in doing that, we want to create generational wealth amongst over 100 Black businesses in every part of the state. And that brings all of this together in a way that we think would make the state feel very good about the way that this community is serving the state. And that's really what it's about. This is not simply a giveaway. It is a way for us to build this bridge so that an economically disadvantaged community can transition to one that is self-determined, self-sufficient, and contributing in a positive way to the domestic product, you know, in the state of Illinois. It's really a pretty simple proposition. Now, if you want, we can talk about the logistics of how that works, but I just wanted to make sure that you have a clear understanding of what it is we're trying to do.
Absolutely. I have a very clear understanding, and I have a few questions, but I want to take a call right now from Nautia, if I'm not mistaken. Is that the correct pronunciation of your name, Nautia?
Yes, it is. Good evening. How are you guys tonight?
Good evening. What's up?
Good evening.
I have a question.
Please.
My question is, can you elaborate on the different types of contracting opportunities that exist for business owners outside of opportunities for doctors or pharmacies?
You know, that's a great question. Thank you for asking. I would ask you to forget that the business that you're talking about is healthcare. And instead, what I would like for you to think about is you're talking about the biggest segment of the economy. So So, you know, I like to say that if, you know, the amount of spend in healthcare is so big that if you're not trying to make money in it, you're really not trying to make money. Once again, if you're an attorney, you could be a healthcare attorney. If you're an accountant, you could be a healthcare accountant. IT, you know, doctor's offices, hospitals, and the whole nine yards all needs IT. There's telemedicine and telehealth these days. Anything that you are doing in business, you probably could be doing in the healthcare space for those managed care organizations, for those hospitals, and all the rest of that. The work that is done by healthcare practitioners is a very small subset. Actually, doctors and hospitals only constitute about a quarter of the healthcare dollar. If you took a dollar up and divided it into where the money is spent, not that much of it, not even half of it, is split between physicians and hospitals. So,
where's the biggest piece? Where's the biggest piece cut? Then, would you think?
Well, you want to take a guess? It's actually in your medications.
That's the biggest cut right there.
Okay. That's right. So, you know, the point to be made here and the direct answer to the question is that there are a limitless number of opportunities in healthcare. And if you actually have a functional business, I would challenge you to challenge me to not find a way where you can do business in the space of healthcare. $3 trillion a year across the United States, no matter what you're doing, it has some type of applicability. In the chamber, what we've done is, you know, the health industry group has actually divided its activities into four different segments. Only one of those segments involves healthcare providers. So the activities of doctors, nurses, and pharmacists and things like that, that's pushed off to the side. And all the other three areas that we're talking about all involve industry. So whatever your business is, I'm very sure, and you can feel free to reach out to me and join the chamber, and we can have the conversation about what we could do to introduce you to the space, because that's what our activity is really meant to do, is to provide opportunities for those that are inclined to run a business successfully.
Now, Tia, did that answer your question?
Absolutely. Thank you. Just clarified for me the different, you know, the spectrum of opportunities that actually exist. I didn't know. So thank you for clarifying.
All right. Thank you for calling. So, Dr. Sterling, I mean, it goes without saying that your wealth of knowledge in this area is far exceeds most people. I mean, it seems like you have dedicated a ton of hours to this objective of making sure that the healthcare industry pays its fair share, or awards its fair share evenly with businesses from the minority, from the black community, that can participate in the goods and services of how this industry functions. And so you stated something that I didn't. You said that the Northwestern's, your hospital, the Rush's, University of Chicago, and others, their minority spend also falls far below what's expected of them?
Well, you know, again, to their credit, they set targets voluntarily. Now, if you are a governmental-based entity, you have to comply with targets that are set at the governmental level.
Sure.
A lot of major corporations, as part of being good citizens, actually also set these targets and do what they can. They all have procurement officers, supplier diversity officers to try to be good citizens. Let me make a point that I think is important to be made here. You know, when I went to Harvard also. That's where I got my business training and my public health training. And, you know, I had a conversation with the president of the university once that I'll never forget, because Harvard is where the whole diversity and affirmative action construct is credited with being founded.
Oh, really?
And, you know, me thinking that there was some type of moral reason for this occurring was actually shot down. And I think the applicability of that here is important to note. You know, the idea behind why Harvard decided that they wanted to do that way back in the 50s had nothing to do with ethics. It really had to do with looking at the changing demographics of the United States. And the notion was pretty simple. If you're going to have a diverse community, the country is going to be better served by having competency amongst all areas of that diverse community.
Sure.
It's a very simple proposition. So you can't have a successful country in which the haves and the have-nots have this huge gulf. So the idea behind affirmative action as was originally proposed was based on opportunity, communities that were disadvantaged coming up and finding their rightful place, not out of justice per se, but out of necessity for the betterment of and the greater good of the entire country. And I think that, you know, what we're looking at here is that a lot of the ills that we talk about so often, I'm sure you've done many, many shows where you've talked about this type of thing. A lot of these folks are making economic decisions. And the best way to get some folks away from doing some of the things that we would describe as societal ills is to put some money in their pocket, or at least give them the opportunity to do that. And that's what we're talking about with education. That's what we're talking about with entrepreneurship and economic opportunities. And at the scale in which we get to the point to where